the truth. Because the truth cannot be told. So that may bring some confusion. So don't trust what I will say. If it brings more confusion, you just forget as soon as you hear it. In the retreat, we speak about many different aspects of our practice and about the spiritual path. Much about suffering, about the emotions, about the Four Noble Truths, and many different aspects. We very seldom speak about Nirvana. So tonight I like to speak a little bit about it. But since it is beyond words, so imagine which situation I am putting myself. That's why I say don't trust me. For a long time after the death of the Buddha, he was never represented on a human form. Since Buddha is not a god, many scholars wonder why for many centuries the Buddha was never represented. Well, we can say later on they really made for what was missing, because nowadays there are so many Buddhas everywhere. It doesn't matter being in a Buddhist country or not, but for 5 or 6 centuries there was no representation of him on the human form. He was just symbolized by a tree, by a footprint, by the wheel, and by a stupa. One may see sometimes the life of the Buddha told where we don't see him, we just see his footprint, the tree, the wheel, and the stupa, but we don't see any human form there. So it is interesting when you see some kind of seat and there is a footprint on the seat showing that's the seat for the Buddha, but he's not there represented. And slowly the stupa, which is a strange monument very specific to the Buddhist tradition, which is like a small hill made out of stone, it's completely full. Inside there may be another small stupa in which there may be ashes of the Buddha or some saint, or in holy books if there were no ashes of people to put in it. But one cannot go inside. And if some of you have made some stupa, the first time is very strange because one is looking for some door to be able to go in. So one may walk around and look for the entrance, and there is no entrance. It's just like a huge stone, like a half of a sphere, placed on the ground, sometimes on a few stairs, and maybe some place to walk around, and that people, devotees may walk around, but no way to get in. It's just plain building. And the first one to be built were built after the death of the Buddha, when they burned his body and they took his ashes and divided it in 8 parts and put in 8 stupa according to the tradition. And it slowly came to symbolize the awakened mind of the Buddha, which is free even of the conditioning of the body. When he was still alive, he had all the condition of the body that he needed to sustain it, to eat, sleep, to get rest. But when he died, then this conditioning of the bodily situation was gone, and it said that the stupa then finally represent the awakened mind of the Buddha, free of any conditioning, bodily and mental conditioning. So in fact, the representation of the Nirvana of the Buddha is a huge stone that is placed in part of India, and after that in many other places in the world, like in Central Asia, in Tibet, China, Japan, and in Southeast Asia. Some of us have gone to Burma, and it's amazing how we can see on hills many, many stupas everywhere, like small trees and painted in white. It's really a very important symbol in the Buddhist tradition. So therefore, if we like to speak about Nirvana, then we may say the stone, because it is what we see when we go in the Buddhist country. The way of speaking. A Christian saint, Christian mystic, said that if, about God, one said that he is a stone, one is much closer to the truth than if one says he is love or he is whatever, because nobody is going to be confused and believe that he is a stone. So he said one is closer to the truth. That's why we may say about Nirvana that it is a stone. Nirvana is understood in the Buddhist tradition, or explained sometimes, as that which is unconditioned. The cessation of suffering, the cessation of conditioning, the unborn, and the unconditioned. So that is the aim of the Buddhist path. And one may inquire into how to follow the path to reach finally this unconditioned. One way of understanding it, not very precisely, but I will follow to show where it will lead us, is to see that since the aim is the unconditioned, then let's try to get rid of all conditioning. If we follow the path of concentration that some people did at the time of the Buddha, believing that we are leading them to the unconditioned, then one sees that first one will get rid of the concern for the object of the senses by choosing one object of concentration, a very simple one, the breath for example, or a sphere of light or whatever, then just placing the mind on that, there will be no any more concern with the object of the senses. Not being concerned with sounds, with sight, tactile sensation, tasting, or thought, the mind will become quiet and will be withdrawn from the world of the five objects of the senses. The mind will not be distracted, will not be disturbed, and the hindrances that we spoke about the other night, they will not have the power to arise anymore. There will be no desire, aversion, agitation, sleepiness, and doubt, because the mind is so much settled in this object of concentration. No room for doubts, no thoughts do arise, no room for sleepiness, the mind is quite clear. And in this object that we have chosen, there is no reason to feel aversion or desire. Imagine a white disc, for example, not so fascinating, it's also not so much disturbing, so not a condition for emotion to arise. No aversion, no desire, no sleepiness, no agitation, and no doubt. And the mind is very quiet, very peaceful. Some people have asked today about the emotion, wondering why they seem to believe that they have a lot of emotion in their daily life, but in meditation they don't experience so many emotions. From the point of view of concentration, we may see that since the mind is not getting so much stimulation from other sources, then some of the emotion will not arise anymore, just because we don't bring the condition for them to arise. It's not that we are cured once for all of all those emotions, it's just that the space for their arising is not there anymore. So in this journey that we are taking now, trying to get rid of all the problems, now we have gotten rid of a few, which are all the emotions coming from the senses. Then the mind becoming quieter and more focused, one may experience some deeper happiness than the happiness of the senses. There may be experience of bliss and rapture, very much more stable than happiness coming from the senses. Yet, if one is on this path of aiming at the unconditioned, one may wonder, and maybe if I am clinging to that deep bliss or happiness from the concentration, maybe I'm conditioning myself. Therefore, the meditator may not cling to his bliss or happiness and then reach a state of equanimity, where the mind will be very peaceful, not experiencing any deep bliss, but a deep sense of peace. So now we have even gotten rid of more things. Before was only the object of the senses. Now even the experience of bliss, rapture, we've gone beyond that. Going on into our journey, then some meditator will not fix their mind anymore into this white disc, for example, because it is still conditioned by here color and shape. Then they will just concentrate their mind on space, much more subtle experience. The only experience arising in their mind will be space, limitless space. So less problem with that, even not the problem that may arise from a white disc. They may see that space is still some growth element and maybe not cling to space anymore and just concentrate on consciousness. The only experience at this time is no sense of any meditator or any object separate, it's just the sense of consciousness, the experience of the consciousness itself. Very subtle experience. Yet it is said that for some meditators they will see this is still too gross. Then they will meditate on nothingness. Seeing that nothingness is still not the end, they will go on the last stage and then meditate on neither perception nor non-perception. So we may imagine that at this time there is not much room for problem. Nothing may arise there disturbing us. In this very deep experience, or can we still speak about experience if we consider that there is neither perception nor non-perception? And it is said in the text that some people believe that they had reached the unconditioned. That was the end. There were no problem anymore. So is it really what's happening in our meditation? Is it what we are aiming at? Developing this state of mind which will be free of any kind of problem because we actually try not to be concerned with them. They will not arise in the field of our experience till finally we are so free of all those because we don't leave any room for them to arise. Then there's no problem anymore. Well, so what's happening in that? We started by saying that the aim of the Buddhist path is the unconditioned, and we tried now, I should say very fast, but following a path, going to this very deep state of neither perception nor non-perception, But what we did in these processes is pushing away actually everything. We slowly avoided, pushed away all the perception, all the emotion, all the sensation, all the thoughts, whatever could arise, we've pushed away. And this state, neither perception nor non-perception, is very much conditioned because it requires the absence of all the rest. So if that would be the unconditioned, it will be a very demanding situation, because this state of unconditioned actually will be very conditioned by the requiring of the absence of all the rest. That will be a kind of very narrow freedom, even if we express it in terms of vastness, because this will require there is no perception, no thoughts, no emotions. It's kind of a no man's land. So it seems that if we follow such a path, avoiding everything, trying to push away all that we may imagine or experience as conditioning, then that just brings to another stage of conditioning, which is the requiring of the absence of something. If we really inquire into the sense of the unconditioned cannot require anything. If the unconditioned require, for example, the absence of conditioning, then it is itself conditioned. Then it is itself very limited. Then it will be a kind of freedom, very limited freedom, some kind of escape. Maybe, let's imagine, like, it will be going out of the world, like an actor will walk out of the stage. Just a way of finding another conditioning. Very, very demanding. Those two, the absence of everything and the world, they are deeply interrelated. It's not possible to reach one without requiring the absence of the other one. So that seems not to be the way to practice to reach the unconditioned. The unconditioned, which is also called the unborn, and we can see in these processes that maybe it will be born or it will appear at the end when there is neither condition, neither perception nor non-perception. We can see that these processes is going over the time. Now, the unconditioned is also the unborn, therefore it cannot depend on time, cannot depend on condition. If it does not depend on condition, one may wonder, how is it possible to do something about it? If we do something about it, that will be conditioning our reaching the unconditioned. Whatever we will do, in the same way as we may be skillful in our daily life to bring some results, bringing the condition in a skillful way, like all the parts to make a car and driving away with it. So if we may try to be skillful in our practice to bring all the condition to be able to reach the unconditioned, it means that our unconditioned is going to be very much conditioned by all that we are bringing into, all that which are, that we are using to reach the unconditioned. So how is it possible to do anything that may help us to reach the unconditioned? Since the very doing of something will be a condition to try to reach that which is beyond condition. Now we are in a difficult situation, because if we don't do anything that many people do, doesn't seem to bring them to the unconditioned. And if we do something, we see that doesn't lead to the unconditioned. So we do or we don't do doesn't change much, actually. the unconditioned stay the unconditioned. So it seems that this notion of unconditioned, nirvana, cessation of the unborn, is kind of a paradox or contradiction in the notion of practicing something to reach it. I like to bring maybe another light to go deeper into this question. Let's consider death, for example. And in a sense, it is very difficult to consider death in a proper way because it seems to contradict life. As long as we see life as something really existing, there is something when death appears, somebody we know, for example, that seems to be a contradiction. Freud used to say that when somebody died, people whispered like if this person had succeeded into a magical trick to do something which is impossible. How is it possible suddenly from being to get out? And there is no being anymore. By which trick is it possible, if one is really alive, existing, suddenly to go into non-existing anymore? And he says there is always a sense of shock, not even if we don't specially love the person, but the death of somebody is putting ourselves into questioning the view that we are seeing our own existence. French writers express that in a very condensed way. He says death betrays the imposture of reality. It is like death reveals that the way we see reality is not a true way. If death is possible, the way we see reality is not a proper way of seeing reality. So we need to reverse that and rather see the nature of death is within life itself, in the sense that the changing aspect of ourselves, of our life and our body is there in the transforming process, that they are not separate entities. We have to see life from the point of view of death to understand and see the possibility to go from life to death. If we are holding firm to the sense of life, then death is something which stays impossible. So the reverse is necessary, to take the point of view from death to observe life, and then we see that is a process of change, impermanent, and sometimes this change will take another aspect, and that we will call death. A British writer started a small piece in a very expressive way. He said birth was the death of him. Not much room for doubt. So to understand this, which did seem difficult to reconciliate, life and death, it seems that we change the point of view, and from the point of view of death, seeing that life, then maybe we can get a sense of their non-contradiction. Maybe with a way of considering the unconditioned and the past. If we consider from the past point of view, which I have taken in a simple way, we see it bring contradiction, even if we will consider the past in a much more complex way. What about if we reverse the point of view and start to see from the unconditioned point of view? Not from the past where it can lead to the unconditioned, but rather seeing the truth of the unconditioned and what will that reveal or tell about the past from the point of view of the unconditioned. When we see the formable truth, the Buddha taught the third before the fall. And the third is the truth of the cessation and the truth of the unconditioned. And he taught it before the fourth, which is the path. He may have had some reason why to teach it in this way. The most logical way will be to tell the path and finally to tell where that reach. You practice those Eightfold Noble Paths and then you will reach the aim, which is the unconditioned. But in his teaching, first he taught the cessation, the unconditioned, and then he explained the path. Let's try to see if it can help us in a hopeless situation. So the unconditioned is that which is not depending on cause and condition, that which is not depending on time, that which is unborn, which is unmade. If we try to bring this light into the past, which means that we will not consider our practice as manipulation that will lead somewhere, we will not consider our practice as a mean to an end, that the practice will be not, will have already the nature of the unconditioned. The practice will not be for the unconditioned, since we saw that nothing can be for the unconditioned. The practice will be itself already unconditioned. The practice will not be conditioned, will not be conditioned by its need to bring or to lead to some aim. So rather than trying to go to this aim, which may be far away or whatever, we reverse that and we see that maybe already the practice can be not conditioned by any attempt to reach something, to manipulate, to transform, and bringing the freedom of the unconditioned as a practice itself, not as the aim of our practice. I read a line or two of Dogen. Then teacher will express that, said, truth is perfect and complete in itself. It is not something newly discovered, it has always existed. Truth is not far away, it is always present. It is not something to be attained, since no one of our steps lead away from it. So I give a sense of what it may mean to reverse our point of view, that all our attempt to transform, to reach, is a stepping out of the unconditioned. When we try to change, to manipulate, to reach, and this already we are transforming ourselves, our practice, into a causal way of dealing, introducing, clinging to the notion of duration, clinging to concept, to the image or concept of what can be reached by that. And by this very process, we are keeping us into bondage. This very process is a conditioning. When the same Master Eckhart, which I quoted at the beginning, expressed that in an interesting way, commenting in one sentence which says, bless the poor in spirit, says, so who are the poor? He said the poor is somebody who has nothing, wants nothing, knows nothing. What does he mean by want nothing? Give us some precision. He said, the one who wants nothing, or to want nothing, is to be free of one's own will as one was before one was. to know nothing is to free of his own knowing as one was before one existed. So no concept of understanding, of knowing. And the one who has nothing, he says it in his own way, says that one is free within oneself of any place that even God could know itself as one was before one was born. Again, there is no much doubt about that. No much room for some kind of trying to sneak something in. So, one should practice or pray, in his language, without why. Any sense of wanting to reach something, to get something, will suddenly bring our practice into the conditioning. Will bring some tension, will bring this kind of sense of movement towards something or towards something that cannot be approached. It means that within our practice, it's required to have this sense of not reaching out, not transforming, not keeping us in bondage by the sense of trying to get rid of bondage, then making bondage solidly existing. I'll tell you one small story about the expression of truth. There was in India, I think by the 6th century, a very well-known Hindu teacher by the name of Ashvaghosha, and he was traveling all over India with his disciples, and the tradition at this time was to debate in logical argument about religion and spirituality whenever one teacher would meet another teacher, and then the one who will lose himself and all his disciples had to convert to the other point of view in religion. And that was very important because some of the great masters, they needed the support from the king of the time for their disciples themselves for getting food and shelter. So it was a matter of great importance when you would debate. So you first would really think about twice before going into an argument and discussion with, because you had to face the consequence. So Ashvaghosha was a fantastic logician and philosopher, and he defeated all the teachers he would meet all over India. His reputation was very well established. So he came to this Buddhist teacher of great reputation also and wanted to debate with him. So he came to him and started to debate. So he had argument and started to ask questions, and this teacher did not open his mouth. Then Ashvaghosha went on, asked questions, then suggested answer, and had other argument, and for some time he just argued, and the Buddhist teacher was kept silent. So after some time Ashvaghosha said, "It's useless. I don't know why you have such a high reputation. You even cannot answer my first question." So he left with all his disciples. I think there were 500 of his disciples, and he went away. While he was walking, then he was reviewing the debate. And he saw that all his arguments could be defeated. But of course, nothing of the silent Buddhist master could be refuted because he had not stated anything. So he said to all his disciples, "Let's go back. I want to meet this teacher again." So he went there and he bowed to him and said, "Well, actually, all what I have said can be defeated. So I really deserve to have my head cut because I'm very stupid and confused." So the Buddhist teacher said, "Well, it's not your head that needs to be cut, but your notions and concepts." And Ashvaghosha stayed there, and actually he has written a few texts, and one text which is a Life of the Buddha in beautiful Sanskrit because he's a fantastic writer. So that was a wise way of his teacher not to open his mouth when he was speaking, maybe about the unconditioned, I don't know. There is another account of expressing what cannot be expressed in words. The Buddha was with a big gathering of disciples, and many were asked to speak about non-duality, or that which is beyond conditioning. So they all spoke in a nice way. But the last one to speak was Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, of course the most bright one. So he spoke the last one and said, the entrance into non-duality, or the unconditioned if you wish, is to know no teaching, to express nothing, to indicate nothing. That is the entrance into non-duality. And at this time he was in the house of this amazing teacher who was called Vimalakirti. So he turned to him and said, well, what is your suggestion about the entrance into the teaching of non-duality or the unconditioned? And Vimalakirti just kept silent. So Manjushri was very pleased and of course praised much Vimalakirti for his wisdom of not opening the mouth where he himself had said a few words. So this reflection on the unconditioned or nirvana sees that the unconditioned or the nirvana or the cessation cannot be the cessation of anything. Because if it is a cessation of something, then it will be conditioned. Cannot oppose that which exists to what which does not exist. It is a cessation of nothing because from the start nothing really was here to condition. And only if we reverse that and think that any attempt to get rid of something is already to give a status of existing, of solidifying these things that we try to get rid of. Transforming our point of view and starting from the unconditioned point of view, see that if we try to get rid of something and to get something, it means that by this belief that we are perpetuating, then we are bringing the notion of condition. We are grasping, holding to the notion of condition. So nirvana cannot be the cessation of anything. It just means that to start with, nothing was conditioned. So the unconditioned or the nirvana cannot be said to exist or not to exist. That will be just to get into the sphere of notion, of grasping and of conditioning, if we started to bring notion to it. So nirvana, the unconditioned, beyond existing and beyond not existing. So maybe we can say that the nirvana is not a store, neither is it anything else. Not to make something out of it. So practically what does it mean for us? Doesn't mean that there is much to change in our practice. We'll keep on sitting and walking and eating. But maybe that may bring a sense of not cultivating this attitude of wanting to interfere with one's meditation. Not wanting to push away and get something, even if it is not nirvana that we are trying to cling to and samsara that we're trying to push away, but even the smallest of our experience, if we are falling into liking and disliking, this smallest attitude, that is conditioning. So it does really require from us this courage to experience what is there, without any anticipation, not to come to sit to reach enlightenment, not having this sense of I want, even if this object that we want is something fantastic or the unconditioned. So bringing this sense of not conditioning our practice or subjecting our practice to any aim and result. We may feel sometimes when we are meditating that suddenly we are slightly tense and our breathing is more difficult, and if we are aware, we may see that there is a reaching out, a slight reaching out for some past experience or expectation, and in this awareness we may see how the smallest expectation already bring tension and already bring a sense of discomfort and suffering, the smallest anticipation, either reaching out or trying to push away. And this very simple attitude remind you of this saying of the third patriarch, said that the great way is not difficult for those who have no preference. And for most of us it is very difficult to believe that really by not having preferences, by not trying to help our practice will be much more balanced and freedom will be within our practice itself. By not helping the practice. There is one story in the Taoist tradition which said that Chuang Tzu was walking with one of his friends and they reached the top of a mountain and they saw all tree all crooked. And the friend of Chuang Tzu said, "What a useless tree." And Chuang Tzu called his attention and said, "This tree is very old because it's all crooked and it's useless. So that has protected him from people who may have cut it down to take the wood to make a house or anything." And he said, "People do not understand how useful it is to be useless." So what does it mean, in a sense, to be useless? It is to be empty of trying to reach something. It is this emptiness of trying to get or get rid of something. That is our uselessness, if you wish, in our practice. Trying not to be useful by transforming and by bringing this sense of aiming at something. So the danger with such a Dharma talk is not that you don't understand me, is that you misunderstand me. Misunderstanding will mean that it is then I stop my meditation. That will be of course a way of misunderstanding. It's rather maybe calling our attention to a slightly more subtle way of practicing, not holding into results or to helping our practice. Slightly more subtle for some of us. And some may already have this sensibility of not trying to help their practice. So to do it in a very, very simple and harmonious way. We may stay a few minutes in sitting in silence.